Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 1 for Autumn Semester 2015. Lecture 23, delivered on November 17, 2015. The title of this lecture is Review for Exam 2.
Today, Review for Exam 2. Exam 2 has the same structure as Exam 1. 6 questions, choose 5. They will be distributed between questions that are just straight and quick one answer and a few that are a little subtler. You're going to have to write a couple of sentences. The rule of no more than 2 sentences will be enforced much more rigorously this time. I stop at the second sentence. Your grammar and punctuation will have to be perfect this time. There won't be any slack cut on that at all. At this point, also your answers have to be much more on point. I'm grading you more tightly, but you're going to do better. It always happens that way. I'm going to go through a few that I think you should know, and we'll try to cover about 20, and I'll go through some that I would recommend you know the answers to. And then you can come back at me with some that you think, and I'll tell you whether they are or are not on the exam. And the wording might not be exactly the same on the exam as what I'm doing here, but it'll be close. Let me go off on a couple of very simple ones. What is meant by optimal capital structure? What is meant by optimal capital structure? That's a straight one-sentence answer. And as a matter of fact, I'll give you exactly what I would expect on that. The optimal capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that minimizes weighted average cost of capital. The optimal capital structure is the combination of debt and equity of a company that minimizes weighted average cost of capital. Now remember, don't abbreviate on my exams, because when you get out there in the real world, you're addressing an intelligent audience, but they might not know what you mean if you write WACC, WACC, or NPV, or IRR. Write things out.
That minimizes weighted average cost of capital?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I could also ask, what is capital structure? What is meant by capital structure? I could ask a slightly more generic question, a general question, and a similarly tight, short answer. Remember, I'm grading about 400 exams, which means that if you decide you want to write a dissertation, that's just going to slow me down and piss me off. Okay? Say what you have to say. That's one of the things that I'm trying to get you to understand in this class is tight, sharp answers are very valuable in the business world. I hear it from executives all the time. So are things like spelling. God, I hear that all the time in grammar. Okay. What is the beta of a security or portfolio measure? What is the beta of a security or portfolio measure? That's another short answer. Really, one sentence. What does the beta of a security or portfolio measure? Woman, can you tell me that?
Yep.
No. That would be a one-point answer. Okay, try again.
Well, if it's high, then it means that you probably shouldn't get it because it's...
You're missing something fundamental at the beginning. You're missing something fundamental. Anyone? No, you. Oh, say what? Go. No, you're describing beta. You're not explaining it. Go. You're almost there. That's 4 points. It measures the beta measures the non-diversifiable risk of a security relative to the market portfolio. That's crucial because another question I ask you, distinguish between systematic and unsystematic risk. And in your explanation of beta, it's crucial that you say beta doesn't measure risk. It measures one kind of risk, the kind of risk that is important. Say that again. The beta of a portfolio measures the non-diversifiable risk of the security or portfolio relative to the market portfolio. Relative to the market portfolio. You've got to make sure that you put that in there. The keys that I will look for as I am reading it will be that you have said non-diversifiable risk or systematic risk, you can say it that way, and relative to the market portfolio. Because no measure has any meaning unless you talk about relative to some standard. So those are the crucials. And that gives you a window in how the grading happens. I'm looking for these keys that show that you have a complete understanding of the concept. Mother's work is never done. Well, I've gone through these in class before, and I've told you I would ask, why is debt cheaper than equity? And you should know that. No, I'm not going to tell you that. Oh, and don't come to my office and say, I just want to run a couple of answers by you. No, I'm not pre-grading your test. You should be able to answer these really straightforward. Explain what is meant by market premium. Now, understand, I don't want to see an equation on this exam. Don't show me equations. I want you to explain things to me. An equation is, it's like in economics. Did you have an economics class where they drew these graphs of supply and demand all the time? That's bullshit. That's a crutch. That's a crutch for not knowing a way to explain it in human language. Math isn't human language. It was invented by robot aliens. And I'm speaking as a former math teacher for many years. Anyway, when I say what is meant by the market premium, I'm asking you to say, well, you could reference the formula R sub M minus R sub F, but you've got to tell me this is your additional reward for bearing the risk of the market instead of risk-free securities. And no, I'm not going to repeat that. You got a podcast you can listen to if you want to catch it all. But it's a short, sharp definition that I'm looking for in these kinds of questions. You'll be able to tell when I'm getting a little bit deeper. Like, for example, explain why the correlation between stock prices is important in constructing a portfolio. Explain why the correlation between stock prices is important in constructing a portfolio. Is important in constructing a portfolio. Now, can you tell me a little bit about that? Now, remember, a complete sentence when you do it on the exam, but you can be a little shorter here if you want. Can you tell me how you would answer that? Would you like to take a stab at it? Why are the correlation why was I showing that on the overhead screen? Actual real correlation coefficients. What's the purpose of that?
Because you want a well-diversified portfolio so that you have various factors of risk so that
you're burying yourself here. You actually kind of know the answer, but you're digging yourself a hole. Stay frosty on the exam. Anyone want to try without the very large hole that was going around the grave there? Say it.
Reduce systematic risk.
No. You were very close there. You were very close there. You shot that RPG and it almost got the bad guys, but darned if you didn't hit the school. That was harsh. Yes. Can you help me? Why is a correlation coefficient between stock prices important in building a well-diversified portfolio?
It reduces the volatility of the portfolio as a whole.
What does?
If the correlations of the stocks are
not very close. Yeah, if the lower the correlation coefficient, the more non-diversifiable risk is removed from a security, from a portfolio. The less correlation two stocks have, the more they're canceling out each other's noise, as it were. You could almost be a little bit loose in that one. Low correlation coefficients are more effective in reducing non-systematic risk, something along that line. You could be a little bit looser on that one, as long as you're showing me that you understand that those correlation coefficients are important because they show how much you are going to get, how much of that noise you can get rid of by putting two stocks together. The lower the correlation coefficient, the more of that noise you tend to get rid of.
Let me do some. Let me do a few more.
Okay, what two ways can a company generate capital through equity? And I'm not talking about preferred versus common stock. What two ways can a firm generate capital through equity? And again, I'm not talking about preferred versus common. And think about where I wrote it right here on the board, right here. You can almost see the ghost of it because these whiteboards kind of are getting old. But you remember what it was? Woman, do you know? What were the two ways you can generate a company can generate capital by selling debt, right? Borrowing money. It can also generate equity through preferred or common, selling preferred or common stock. But there's another way that it can generate equity.
Integrated.
Huh?
Integrated.
Oh, no. That was like over on the other side of the Chick-fil-A. Can you help me out at all on this one? Bingo. What do I mean by internally generated equity versus externally generated equity? Do you know that?
No.
It's a fundamental principle of business that you've got to make money. Internally generated equity is money at the bottom line. Remember, money at the bottom line belongs to the shareholders. It's equity. You can actually earn money doing your business, and that's money that you can invest in capital projects. Or you can sell common stock. That's externally generated equity. Either way, you can pull in money, but it's a pretty good idea if at least in the long run you generate money internally to finance your projects rather than generating money externally. At least sometimes you have to generate money externally because a capital project is so large, and that would be through debt or equity. Go.
I didn't hear what they said was the answer for that.
Internally generated equity versus externally generated equity.
You should say
internally generated equity, which is money earned at the bottom line by the company, versus externally generated equity, which is money that is brought in through the sale of common stock. Go.
Is it wrong to call internally generated dividends?
No. Oh, that would be exactly what you wouldn't have. You see, because dividends, you don't have to for projects. At the bottom line, you've got earnings. Now, the company can decide that it wants to give all those earnings away to the shareholders, but then it doesn't have any of that money as capital to reinvest. So before any decision is made about dividends, at the bottom line, at the net income line in accounting terms, they've got shareholder money. They could use it to finance capital projects. It's equity. Or they could say, well, we don't want to use that money for projects. We want to give that as dividends, but we still need money, so we'll sell common stock. That's externally generated equity. Now, let me put in a few stronger ones here. Actually, this one's fairly straightforward. Suppose a company has set a hurdle rate of 8% on new projects that are accepted. A company has set a hurdle rate of 8% on new projects that are accepted. You have found that the internal rate of return on a proposed new project is 10%. Will you accept it or reject it, and why? Again, a company has a hurdle rate of 8% on new projects. You have found that a proposed new project has an internal rate of return of 10%. Will you accept it, or will you reject it, and why would you do that? The company's hurdle rate is 8%. You've got a project that's showing an internal rate of return of 10%. So what would you say? Do you accept it, or do you reject it? Can you tell me?
Accept it.
Yes. Why?
Because...
A little tougher. I'd give you a few points for that, especially if I'd finished off my first bottle of Jack. But okay, if the hurdle rate is 8%, this think about how that net present value line falls. The internal rate of return is where it crosses the axis. So if the hurdle rate is 8%, this thing is hitting the zero net present value at 10%. So below 10%, this thing has a positive net present value. So if you've got an 8% hurdle rate, that thing is still up here, a positive net present value is coming down. So in other words, you would say something to the effect, this project internal rate of return of 10%, this project has a positive net present value at 8%. In other words, if I plugged 8% into the NPV calculation of it, it'd be positive because it's still positive clear up to 10%. That's what the internal rate of return means. Below 10%, the project is, for a 10% internal rate of return, below 10%, the NPVs are all positive. Above 10%, the NPVs are negative. If the hurdle rate, this company says, hurdle rate 8%, well, shoot, this project's still positive at 8%, positive NPV, because this project will have a positive net present value at any rate less than 10%. Go.
So if the hurdle rate would be above 10%, it would be a negative?
Absolutely, yeah. You think about it, I'm glad you brought that up. You think about it, the hurdle rate is sort of your cutoff. So that if you set a hurdle rate, any IRR above that hurdle rate is going to be a yes. Any IRR below that hurdle rate is going to be a no. That's how you would do to put it compactly. I'm glad you brought that up. It's sort of like the best way to think about it, maybe. Yes.
Are you going to ask us why the hurdle rate sometimes isn't a good indication of the
NPV? No, that would actually, what I will probably do is, those are a little subtler for a final exam kind of question. That would be, that's a little deeper. Okay, yeah. At the final exam, there'll be some easies, but then there'll be some where you're actually stepping back and analyzing what I've shown you over the semester and giving a more objective critique of method and outcome. Now, I'm going to go through there will be three deep questions, more deeper questions, and you'll see two of them possibly on the exam. And you'll have, so you're going to have to cross answer one of the heavies. But before I go to that little part, it's your turn. You tell me, you ask me a question, and I'll tell you whether that is a question that would be on the exam or not. It's your turn here. Go. No. No. You do not bring a calculator. Don't bring a cell phone, or if you have one, turn it off. You can live without it for a while. No computers, just you, and a note card, and a pencil, for God's sake. Pen, I had, you know, anyway, yeah, that's all. Go ahead, your turn, go. No. That's a little too mathy. Mathy? Is that a word? You got, I mean, you get the crap beaten out of you on those online assessments with math. I mean, this is where you get to show us your artistic side, your sensitive side. Indeed, your flower that is in your brain wanting to blossom. That was creepy. Okay, other question. You don't have any? Yeah, go ahead.
Two reasons why debt's more attractive than equity.
Good. Why? Well, that goes to the why is debt cheaper than equity? Which would be cheaper means more attractive. Yes. And there's another one that I will bring up too. That's a lie. It's a different question. Why is debt more favorable for large corporations than for small corporations? Why is debt more favorable for large corporations than for small corporations? Remember I went on about that? Go ahead. Do you have an answer to it?
Oh, yeah, their interest rates, or their tax rates lower.
Whose is?
Have
a higher. So the tax deductibility of interest is stronger for them. It was like this. You remember that we count a firm's debt, after-tax cost of debt, is the cost of debt times 1 minus the marginal tax rate of the corporation. So at higher and higher tax rates, marginal tax rates, which a large corporation would have a higher tax rate than a smaller corporation, this is a much stronger effect. This is the one I talked about with rich people versus working class and poor people. I mean, for rich people, the tax mortgage interest deductibility is massive compared to what it is for people who have lower tax rates because they have lower incomes. In other words, we are essentially crowding home ownership to the wealthy and leaving everyone else in rental living types of environments because of the way our tax code works. Progressive tax, sure. Tax the rich more because the marginal utility of their last dollar is less. However, at the same time, the perverse, it's what we call a perverse effect. That it actually encourages more home ownership by rich people than from poor people, and in corporations, it encourages more debt by large corporations than by smaller corporations in their capital structures. Now, there's another question that is allied with that, and I'll bring that one up. And I talked about this, the Modigliani-Miller paradox, and I won't call it that on the exam. I wouldn't call it that. But if debt is cheaper than equity, which it is, why aren't corporations 100% debt? If it's cheaper than equity, why aren't corporations 100% debt? And that you can go through the lecture I went on about that, what the real-world problem is with that theoretical example. I mean, Modigliani and Miller knew that their paradox had an answer. But they were proposing it anyway to make us focus on what that answer is. Yes, debt is cheaper than equity as a rule, but that breaks down at a certain point for a corporation. Now, another one that I'll tell you, identify 2 points on the security market line. Identify 2 points on the security market line. Now, you had a graph I drew in class, and I explained it very clearly. Remember that the security market line, beta is on the horizontal axis. The expected return is on the vertical axis. No, don't draw me a graph on an exam. This is a written exam. And I showed you this is the security market line, SML. I showed you a point, 2 points on that line. And the question for you is, what are those 2 points? Identify 2 points on the security market line. No doubt about it. There are 2 points that you will always know. Because that's what defines, that's what makes the line. Remember, 2 points make a line and all that kind of stuff. There are 2 points that we know, definitionally almost, are on the security market line. They are the point where, well, in general, I know, without looking at any stock charts or anything like that, or looking at betas on Yahoo Finance or anything like that, I know the beta of 2 specific securities, or shall I say portfolios. I know the beta exactly of 2 specific portfolios. Both of them are theoretical, but we can make them in practice pretty darn close. Do you know what they are? Do you know the beta? And I'll just say one more thing about this. You know damn well what the beta of a riskless portfolio would be. And you know darn well what the beta of a market portfolio would be. You know exactly what they are, and I've almost given you the whole answer doing that. Now, let me go through a couple of... Now, you're going to have to answer one of them because you'll have 2 of these slightly meatier questions on the... exam, so you'll have to deal with one of them. Comparing a young investor in his or her mid-20s with an older investor in his or her mid-50s. Okay, we're comparing a younger investor in his or her mid-20s and an older investor in his or her mid-50s. What would you expect to find about the relative betas of their 2 portfolios? And why would you expect to find this? Again, what would you expect to find about the relative betas of their respective portfolios? And why would you expect to find this? Now this goes, you're not going to answer it, but yeah. I was going to say, don't answer it, but no. I want you to work on this, suffer with it. And it'll be worded, if you see it on your exam, it'll be identical, almost identical in wording to that. But I want you to think about that. Because it's one of those questions that's actually relevant in your life. Right now, you're young. You probably haven't even got a portfolio, and if you do, it sucks. But once you get out there and start making money, you'll start, no, that's right, most of you will be in a pile of student debt your whole life. No, you'll start forming a portfolio, and then you will keep an eye on that portfolio, and if you're smart, you will be moving the beta as time goes on of the portfolio. This shows me that you understand what to do, what you will probably do, what we would expect you to do, what we would hope you would do. That's one of the, by the way, one of the big problems with this idea keeps coming around. We want to privatize sociable security so people can invest their own money. Good God, 300 million people, almost 95% of them are financially illiterate. I mean, you guys know more than 95, 98% of everyone in finance. Can you imagine 300 million people trying to invest their own money? Dear God, would that be fun to watch? Oh, I'd make a lot of money, I'm sure, off those suckers. Anyway, okay, let's try something else here. Another one that would be one of the, a little bit more analytical, spanning Bloom's taxonomy of learning from elementary to high cognitive skills. We're now in the high cognitive skills. A fund manager is featured and praised on the Financial News Network because he had the highest portfolio return of all fund managers last year. Fund manager is featured and praised on the Financial News Network because he had the highest return on his portfolio of all fund managers last year. Yeah?
I remember you talking about this. I don't exactly remember the day. Do you remember which?
Oh, dear. I know, right? I am getting too old to remember what I had for breakfast, for God's sake. That would be, I would bet you that would be in the one risk and expected return lectures. There were a pair of them. And that was when I really began to jump on this topic. Yeah, it would be in your risk and expected return. Look for the titles of the lectures, risk and expected return. And I also talked about early in the semester, but it probably kind of went by you. I was doing that first layer early on. Okay, now, by the way, the upshot, the question part is, why should you not be impressed by this fund manager? Why should you not be impressed by this fund manager? And I will give you this. You should know damn well that there is no such thing in this world as expected return without you remember that song? Goes together like a horse and carriage. Love and marriage goes together like... Would you like to dance? Okay. Oatmeal and brown sugar. There's no such thing as oatmeal. Oatmeal sucks. You have to have brown sugar with it. White Castles. There's no such thing. You have to have whiskey. Most of it in your stomach before you eat them. A toilet without toilet paper. It's just not going to happen. A cat without disrespect for you. It just doesn't happen. ISIS without black robes and evil. The point, though, is that simplistically, we talk about a return. You hear that expected return or return, the return is. Well, that doesn't exist without something happening before. High salary. Well, that doesn't exist without this kind of painful education from losers like me. You got to know that there's something that goes with it and is intimately related to expected return. So when they pat these fund managers on the ass and say, isn't he wonderful because he got such a high return, that just should not impress you at all unless they explain something else. And they show that he met another criterion with that. And a hint about that, securities market line. I'll even draw that securities market line again for you.
Thank you.
There's where that fund manager could be. There's where that fund manager could be. That's a nice high return. But he could have gotten the same return without something. You can show me all day long that you got a high return on a portfolio, and I will simply wait for you to show me something else about that portfolio. Now, the other one that is one of your high cognitive skills one. On a financial news show, the talking head shows the price chart of a stock and notes that there is clear and obvious price volatility, a lot of it. He shows the price of a stock. On the financial news network, a talking head shows a price chart of a stock. This price chart shows a lot of volatility. It's clear and it's obvious that there is extraordinary price volatility. But then he says, this is clearly a very risky stock. Why could he be dead wrong? This is clearly, he shows the stock, no doubt about, there is price volatility like you wouldn't believe. And then he goes on to say, this is obviously a very risky stock. He might be dead wrong. He might be completely wrong. This might be a very low-risk stock. Why? I'm not going to give you anything except to talk to you. There was actually a chart in the book showing a couple of stocks, like Microsoft, showing its price volatility. I think the other one was Apple or Google or something like that. I can't remember what the other one was. But it showed total risk, and then it divided that risk up. Remember that risk is not what we care about in finance. I don't give a rat's ass what the risk of a security is. I care about something else. You could be ugly as, I mean, you could be so ugly you'd knock a bulldog off a meat wagon. But if I am hiring someone who is a genius, and you are a genius at computers, which clearly you are not, based on all that data set you're struggling, no. I gave him a hellaciously hard project. We can't care in business about the big picture, like, well, risk. In finance, we can't care about that because it's not relevant. Risk is, so don't talk to me about risk. Talk to me about something risk, okay? There's a word that has to come in front of risk before you will get me to pay attention. There's it, as it turns out, you, madam, are a werewolf. The rest of the time, you are a great employee, and at the monthly dinner functions, you make a hellacious cheesecake. Okay? But you're a werewolf. Now, of course, with a werewolf, there is one night every month when the moon is full, and you go from, I've got all my Excel spreadsheets done, can I do some more work for you? To, I'm going to gnaw your thigh. Okay? Now, should that matter to me? No. Why? No. Well, yeah, you're able to do your job, but no. One night a month, I can just put you in an iron cage and say, bad dog, and give you some puppy chow. And maybe some student that I didn't like to eat. You see, because I can contain that. I can make it mitigated. I can make it go away. But I have to pay attention to do that. If I miss, oh, damn, it's a full moon. Uh-oh, where is she? I forgot to block her up. Then you're tearing up the countryside. And you come back all bloody and all that kind of stuff. And, oh, you know, you always bring me back a couple of steaks, but porterhouse. Tastes a little salty. I think they were people steaks. But the point here being that I can contain you. Okay? And that's the thing in finance. Risk is irrelevant. It is a certain kind of risk that is all that matters. And sometimes when you're in that werewolf thing, oh my God, you're horrible. You're big and hairy and you got really bad breath and you really should floss, seriously, because when those teeth come out, I can see but I can make that go away. So when that talking head shows you price volatility and says, this is very risky, you can't look at a price chart and say whether or not a stock is risky to a finance person. You have to tell me something else about the risk, something that is hidden. And remember that those charts, they showed that a lot of stocks have extraordinary price volatility. But that's irrelevant because that's not what we care about. And you dig back through, you'll find it in my lectures. I was yelling and farting about that all the time. Now, other questions from you. What else do you want to know is going to be on it or off it? Because I can knock it off. I can knock it off your study list. I've covered about 18 so far. There are a few loose ends here. No. You should already know what capital projects versus capital market versus money market. Yeah.
Do we need to know about quotation costs?
No. Yes. Yes, that was one of the first things I brought up. What is meant by optimal capital structure? What is meant, and that's a one sentence, short, fast answer. Again, don't abbreviate WACC, W-A-C-C and all that. Write words out. You're professionals about to be, God help us. Go.
What about the differentiation relationship between fixed and variable costs?
No, I'm going to save that for the final exam. That I'm still letting you emotionally get past the chickens. Yes. There's one that came from yesterday, and I'll bring it up again, is that I could ask you, and this is relevant right now, because the Federal Reserve is on the verge of starting to push interest rates up. They're scared to do it, but they know they got to do it sooner or later. How do rising interest rates affect the number and risk of projects accepted? How do rising interest rates in the economy affect the number and risk of projects accepted? You see, because rising interest rates, they cause business slowdowns, but that's separate from how they cause bankruptcies. In rising interest rate environments, you'll see business activity slow down. But separately, you'll see bankruptcies happening. Hell, the great recession we went through from 09 to whenever it actually technically ended, the number of bankruptcies was hellacious of companies. But business was damn slow, too. Now, slow business can hurt you, especially if you have high fixed costs. Remember that. And I can attest to that. Good God. Business does slow down. Interest rates go up, opportunity costs of capital, all that kind of stuff. But there's separately, bankruptcies happen. So this is related to that quite intimately for our current time. When interest rates go up, how does that affect the number of projects accepted? And how does and the risk of projects that are accepted? Now, I want you to think, one way that you could think about it, and I go back to one of those methods that I'm not particularly happy with, are hurdle rates. Suppose that a company has an active oversight of its hurdle rate. Now, I told you there are a lot of companies I've run into that had hurdle rates they hadn't changed in years. But there are companies that have hurdle rates, and they move the hurdle rate with interest rates. As a matter of fact, sometimes you'll peg it to some kind of a base rate like LIBOR or the Treasury bill rate or the federal funds rate. And so the hurdle rate moves with these underlying interest rates. So you might want to think about it that way. If you've got a hurdle rate that's moving with underlying macroeconomic interest rate environment, what does that mean about the number of projects that would be accepted and the risk of projects that are accepted in a rising interest rate environment? That can give you a window on what's going to happen when the Fed starts to push up interest rates. And it will. On a practical level, companies accept more projects, they hire more people. Companies that accept fewer projects hire fewer people. So that kind of makes it a relevant question for you, considering that you will be out there looking for jobs you should start looking well within a year. So that kind of tells you something about what's going to happen with you by paying attention to interest rates and know how they are connected to projects, the number of projects companies take on, and the risk of projects the companies take on. Good question. What else? Got anything else for me? Well, if not, come here bright and early. You do have a note card you can use for this. Otherwise, no phone, no calculator, nothing like that. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.